Hello, Clarice. You're one of Jack Crawford's, aren't you? Come closer.
Hello, beautiful humans. I'm Tymie Castle.
And I'm Benjamin Mead.
And you're listening to Just a Minute. Just a Minute is an educational podcast where we break down justice topics in 30 minutes or less. Today's topic, criminal profiling and the Idaho student murders. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Hello, Ben.
Well, hi there.
I'm going to ask you to put on your profiler cap as you're thinking about this scenario that I'm going to walk you through, okay?
Okay, sounds good. I'll try to use my mystical powers to intuit the shoe size of whatever the murderer criminal is that you're going to tell me about.
Okay, so I'm just giving you a crime scene. So a person is rummaging through dumpsters for whatever. I think it was aluminum cans, or as the Brits say,
aluminium.
But this was in 1996. So anyway, this person comes across the body of a woman. She was bisected at the waist, and only the top half was in the dumpster inside of a garbage bag.
And by bisected, I assume that means cut in half.
Yes, cut in half.
Did you see that spoof movie? I think it was called Walk Hard. It was the spoof of the Johnny Cash biopic.
No.
Yeah. Well, anyway, you know, like Johnny Cash's little brother gets like killed as a kid.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Well, in the documentary, like he's like, gets sawed in half.
Okay, so bisected.
By a saw, yeah. Uh-huh. But like he's still alive and he's laying on the ground. He's like, I'm cut in half real bad. That's one of my favorite lines. Like, I'm cut in half real bad.
So, listeners, that's the visual for bisection.
Yep.
So she was bisected at the waist, like I said, and okay, body was in garbage bag. So upon examination, the body had been carefully cleaned before being put in the garbage bag and in the dumpster. The bisection was a clean cut with some kind of saw, likely electric, and the bottom half was never found. But the top half was enough to identify the victim as a Swedish au pair working in the Boston area at the time, who was located pretty closely to where she had gone out the night before, as young people do, to a bar. So given the state of the body and the dumping site, what are some logical assumptions that we might make?
Well, I mean, you kept saying like before she was put in the dumpster. So I imagine that would clue me into like she was not killed and cut in half real bad in the dumpster.
Right.
So probably happened somewhere else.
Correct. Yes. Nice. So bisection did not happen there. Right. Especially since the body was cleaned. There was no blood or anything like that.
True.
So also, why might someone bisect a body before dumping it?
I would say make it harder to identify, but like if you find the top
half,
that's going to be the easier part to identify. Right. Other than that, I don't know. I don't know.
Yeah, so just easier for disposal purposes. Because if you are like trying to carry a body in a garbage bag, you know, and also they never found the bottom half. So they did dispose of it quite well, actually, if not for the dude looking for cans, then it wouldn't have been found.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So is this an unsolved mystery? Do they know who did it?
No.
Did they ever find out?
It's unsolved. It's a cold case. Wow. There was also a random saw blade in the dumpster, but they couldn't link it to the body. But if it's not related, then that was a very weird coincidence.
Yeah.
So obviously the killer did not want the body to be found because he successfully hid the other half, right?
Yeah, right.
So the reason I started with this case as an introduction to profiling is because I also listened to a podcast called The Consult, where the co-hosts are former profilers in the FBI's behavioral analysis unit. And this unit was originally made famous by...
Hello, Clarice. You're one of Jack Crawford's, aren't you? Come closer.
So I wonder, you know, how many of our listeners actually have seen Silence of the Lambs? I mean, because it was very popular when we were growing up, but I'm not sure about the longevity of that film.
I mean, it's so ingrained in pop culture. If they haven't seen it, people would know... would get that reference from Silence of the Lambs.
Yeah, probably like, you know, especially when he's talking about eating people, you know, with a glass of Chianti and vodka. Yeah, that part. Yeah, so this was based on a very popular earlier book and kind of introduced the FBI profiler to the world.
Yeah.
So criminal profiling has been on my list of topics for a while, and the consult also covered the Idaho student murders because now the suspect is no longer alleged.
Yeah, he guilty because he pled guilty on July 2nd to burglary and all four murders of Madison Mogan, Kaylee Gonsalves, Zana Kernodle, and Ethan Chapin to avoid the death penalty, and also by doing so waived his right to appeal.
Right. So what we're going to do in this episode is introduce criminal or offender profiling and then talk about both the myth and actual utility, if any, of profiling, especially in regard to these high profile cases.
Yeah.
So the FBI's BAU was brought into the Idaho investigation in the first few weeks before they had identified a suspect. They did not give a profile that aided in identifying a suspect, contradicting many depictions thanks to shows like Criminal Minds.
Yeah, Criminal Minds is probably the worst. I mean, like, you know, they make it seem like you can just like look at a crime scene and the way blades of grass are laying and figure out how old and you know, shoe size and race and all of these other details about the killer. And also that every town has, I mean, there's like probably like 30 seasons of Criminal Minds or something like that now.
Every town.
Yeah, every town. They've had to start like visiting towns twice. So every town has at least two serial killers.
Right. Mm-hmm. So when people think about criminal or more accurately offender profiling, what pops up in their head is typically this process of using crime scene evidence to make inferences about potential suspects, including personality characteristics and psychopathology.
Yeah. And it's almost kind of presented like some almost like mystical or clairvoyant powers where you like close your eyes and put your head up to your temples and intuit something magical or something like that.
And then there's the super genius, right? Mm-hmm. Like the one who's like the super genius, who's like the Sherlock Holmes-ish character.
Right.
Yeah. So, yeah, studies have shown that profiling is not an evidence-based practice.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, a 2007 meta-analysis. So, you want to just like briefly for listeners, lay terms, explain what a meta-analysis is?
Yeah, I've used that term a lot. But
I think we have.
I don't think we've explained it. But a meta-analysis is basically a statistical assessment of a body of research. You try to take all of the existing studies that there are and put them together and try to analyze them and calculate, you know, effect size and power of magnitude. So meta-analyses are an easy way in usually pretty straightforward way to kind of wrap your head around the state of the body of literature and research and studies on a particular topic.
Yes. And there's a reason why we've mentioned them several times, right? Because of that.
Yeah. So, yeah, instead of having to read 50 or 75 articles, you can just read one meta-analysis.
Mm-hmm. So criminologists Snook et al., and there were like five of them, so I'm not going to name them all. Sorry, guys. Compared four studies where self-described criminal profilers analyzed crime scene data, came up with a profile, and then compared their predictions to other groups like normal detectives and college students.
Oh, interesting.
So profilers did only slightly better than random people at predicting traits of offenders.
Mm-hmm.
So they concluded that it's a pseudoscientific technique of limited, if any, value to investigators.
I'm shocked. That's shocking.
So even worse, a group of researchers at the University of Liverpool, led by psychologist Lawrence Allison, evaluated whether you could draw any conclusions about a criminal based on the characteristics of a crime and crime scene. And what do you think the answer to that was?
Probably not. I mean, unless they leave some physical evidence telling you that.
Yes.
But just like looking at the way, a body's positioned or laid or, you know, things like that, you can't just, use your profiling skills and figure out how tall this person is or something like that.
Yeah. So the answer is no. But this study actually called into question something that we actually think is accurate, and that's about averages. So they compared 100 British rapists, all men, all targeted women 16 and older, and all rapists attacked strangers. And they found that, quote, neither age, sociodemographic features, nor previous convictions established any links with offense behavior. And there were really no similarities in how they committed the crimes or the modus operandi or MO. So you can't look at a crime scene and conclude stuff like the offender is a 25 to 35 or 34 year old white man who dropped out of high school. You can't even do that.
And you know, on the other hand, we know that if you collect enough data, though, you can draw some conclusions.
Right. So we know that as social scientists. But this is not a profiler catching a serial killer with the power of their mind, as you mentioned. Averages are about statistics and probability. It is induction based on observation or, as pointed out in the Snook study, common sense. So this is why I asked you about the case in the intro. Knowing very little except what was found and where can tell you a few things, and this only requires basic critical thinking skills. Oh, the body was clean, so the body was cleaned and bisected elsewhere. Statistically, if we know that 85 to 90% of homicides are committed by males, then when we find a woman murdered, it is most likely a male who did it. That's not profiling. So I think we should also add that profiling was popularized specifically with serial murder, especially after shows like Mindhunter on Netflix, which is a drama based on the real life work of Anne Burgess, who I got to see speak at a conference on serial murder. And FBI agents in the early days of the BAU, as they were collecting data on serial killers, they started that data collection process, but it was qualitative interview based in order to build profiles. So now they do more totality in terms of analysis. They actually call it criminal investigative analysis. They don't call it profiling anymore. Even if on the consult, they still call themselves former FBI profilers.
So how have the investigative analysts or former profilers on the podcast you listened to talked about the Idaho case?
Yes. So they focus on the timeline and look at things like post-offense behavior, offense behavior, victim selection, choice of weapon, etc. So first, let's say, and again, go back to previous episodes, that this is a mass murder. His original plan may have been to only kill one person, but he ended up killing four in a single event, which makes it a mass murder. So this is an important clarification because much of the behavior from an analysis standpoint seems to have more in common with serial homicide. So Kohlberger, or as the subreddit on Idaho murders calls him Clownberger. Clownberger was at the time of the crime a 27-year-old PhD student in criminology and criminal justice at Washington State University in Pullman. There's been a lot of discussion online about how he could have gotten into this program given how much he messed up the crime. But as we discuss in our very first episode, you do not study criminology to learn how to commit a crime.
I'm imagining like a practical exam to get into a criminology program where you have to commit a crime and get away with it. Before you're admitted. That's not. That's
Well, we would never have gotten in if that was the case.
No, that's definitely true. But yeah, you know, we've talked about before, criminology is not about, like, you know, how to commit crime and get away with it or crime scene investigation, but it's a social scientific analysis of, you know, trends and social factors associated with crime and finding crime, criminal justice.
So, you know, just for those online people, let's just throw this out there that the WSU program, so Washington State University, that program, that criminology program, is highly ranked. And friend of the show, Dr. Mary Pierce's whole family went there. Well, not really her whole family, but her dad, Greg Pierce, graduated from that program, and her niece, Maggie, also graduated from that program. So they are a WSU Cougar-loving football family. And in 2022, after Greg passed, they took a blow-up cutout of his face to a WSU game.
That's cute.
So I wanted to give a shout-out to Beth Pierce, who said she was going to listen to this episode. So if you're listening, Beth, we'd love to send you a T-shirt.
Yeah, hey, Beth. Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
And checking us out. And hey to Mary, too. She's also a good friend of the podcast.
Friend of the show. So, Ben, how common is it for a PhD candidate to be a suspect in a quadruple murder?
I mean, you know, like I said before, there's probably like been zero school buses hijacked by serial killers, and I was actually wrong on that.
Actually, so, there was one.
So I'm hesitant to say zero, but I'm going to say zero. Like, this is probably the first.
Yes.
Would be my guess.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this doesn't mean that previous serial killers haven't had experience with criminal justice, right? Like Bundy notoriously studied law. The Golden State Killer was a cop. Mm-hmm. And BTK, Dennis Rader, also had a criminal justice degree. But in this case, the suspect is highly unusual. Usually, if you're in a PhD mm-hmm. program, you have succeeded academically and have at least some stakes in conformity.
Yeah, you're like, you know, committed to school and, you know, you have those commitments that you don't want to lose or put at risk by committing crime.
Right. Mm-hmm. So now that Clownberger has accepted a plea agreement, the Moscow, Idaho Police Department is publishing documents related to the case on their website. And there are over 300, so I needed time to read them all in case there was new information mm-hmm. there that we previously didn't know.
Nice.
So now what we'll do is walk through some of the facts or details about the crime and put on our profiler hats again for some criminal investigative analysis.
Right.
So first, let's talk about how Koberger was identified. FBI profilers were called in to construct a profile based on crime scene evidence and developed a profile that included the possibility that the killer was a criminal justice student.
Not.
Yes. So first, we didn't even know that FBI profilers were called in until one of the prosecutors mentioned it in a recent interview. They kept that close to the vest, but they didn't help very much.
Again, shocking.
Shocking. He stated that the people from the FBI's BAU told them that regarding motive, that they would likely never know why he did it. And if he did tell them, first of all, you can't believe what he's saying. Mm-hmm. His reason would not likely make sense to ordinary people. And so they gave some advice when it comes to victim statements and telling the victims information. Mm-hmm. They just basically said there was no point in compelling him to disclose mm-hmm. his motive since it would likely just further victimize the families.
Well, again, I mean, that's just underscores kind of like the, I'm trying to figure out a word here. Like, I was going to say, like, ludicrous. Anyway, how just, like, ridiculous this idea of profiling is. Like, oh, we're coming in to do a profile. We'll never know.
Yeah, right.
So it's like, yeah, you can't just intuit these things. They didn't create a profile and included a possible suspect who studied cloud-based forensics and crime scenes and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That, again, highly unusual suspect, right? Mm-hmm. So it was the initial video canvassing in the first couple of weeks that produced the Ring camera footage from a nearby residence that captured the car.
Mm-hmm. In from the camera footage, so you can see it's a white Hyundai Elantra without a front license plate circling the property on 1122 King Road, beginning around 3:30 in the morning, making several rounds and then stops around 4 a.m. and then finally like speeds off around 4:20.
Right. Because of the car captured on video, they alerted law enforcement in the surrounding areas, which included Pullman, since it's only 10 minutes away, in a bolo. Be on the lookout for, and a security guard found his car in the parking lot of his apartment complex. Mm. That's how the suspect was first identified.
Mm-hmm. Good old-fashioned police work.
Yeah, so target selection and choice of weapon might give you some insight into motive, but it's not going to pull someone out of a hat.
Yeah.
So let's go down that rabbit hole. Get it?
Yeah, pulling out of a hat, pull a rabbit out of a hat. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one of my lame jokes. Yours are always so much better. So anyway, the weapon was a knife, and all four victims died from stabbing injuries. Only one victim had anything other than stab wounds, some asphyxiation trauma, and blunt force to the face. So what might any of this tell you?
I mean, if you're using a knife, you got to kind of get up close to the victims and kill them. And that's kind of much more intimate compared to using a gun. Also, I mean, I didn't know that about like the asphyxiation and trauma. And, I mean, I guess there could be a couple of explanations for that. But to me, I might think like, oh, maybe that's the person he was really interested in because he's like choking them and hitting them.
Right. But you would
I don't know.
Mm-hmm. You would think. So yes, the use of a knife is important. You want the visceral experience of killing someone, or it's a convenience weapon, but we know that's not the case, right? Yeah. A convenience weapon of a knife is like an escalating argument or something. There are other facts
it wouldn't be something that he like bought ahead of time and brought with him. It would be something he kind of picked up maybe even at the crime scene.
Yeah, in the house. Mm-hmm. So the facts we now know is that he purchased the K-bar knife and sheath 8 months before the crime, so while he was still living in Pennsylvania. He was only in Washington for about a month before his phone begins to ping around the address. Wow. And so he's there a month, discovers the target or the house, and then his phone pings 23 times in this area up until November 7th or a week before mm-hmm. the murders. So what might yeah. all this suggest?
So like his phone's ping at the house?
In the area. They can't put mm-hmm. it right at the house.
But on the cell phone tower. In the neighborhood, yes. Like on the street.
Yes.
And this is for months ahead of.
Yeah.
Months ahead of.
Actually,
crime.
1 month after mm-hmm. he moved there.
Mm-hmm. Which was like in June or something. So like from yes. July to November, he was in the neighborhood where this house was.
Right.
So, I mean, that means he was like, had already identified them as their target and were maybe like stalking them or like scoping out the house. But yes. I mean, for like months at a time, that yes. seems like stalking more so than planning or preparing.
Yes. Some pretty serious stalking.
Yeah. And apparently there were like reports from friends that Kaylee had seen a shadow in the woods when she let the dog out one time. And on another occasion felt like she was being followed home.
Yeah. Those are all yeah. things in hindsight. You're like, oh, this happened. It could have been nothing, but it also could have been him.
Mm-hmm.
From a profiling perspective, these previous times could have been for multiple reasons. He could have been building up the courage to do it. He could have been engaging in the fantasy of killing and learning their movements all at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So all the pings were between the hours of 10 and 4 a.m., and people in the house were likely all in bed by 4, which mm-hmm. is something he probably learned on those previous, mm-hmm. You know, times he was there.
Yeah.
So when he enters the residence, he goes directly up to the third floor, killing Maddie and Kaylee in their bed, encounters Zanna somewhere, not exactly sure, kills her and her boyfriend Ethan, who is also in bed. Kaylee and Zanna had the most stab wounds at over 30 for Kaylee and over 50 for Zanna.
Oh my gosh.
We know Zanna was awake because of her DoorDash order and TikTok timestamps, and she was the only one with significant defense wounds. Mm. So it was obviously she had run away from him mm-hmm. and very clearly awake. Kaylee might have also woken up while being stabbed, which could explain the other injuries.
Oh.
So all of this occurs in under 20 minutes. So what do you think he learned on those previous occasions that would have been helpful to pulling this off?
Well, I mean, you mentioned this earlier, like the routine, what time they go to bed, when would be a good time to slip in, how many people live there, like where their bedrooms were located. And
right. Yes.
Those would all be things you could kind of figure out from watching from the outside.
And he also learned how to gain access. So this is someone who engaged in preparatory activities to commit a murder and then carried it out. The stalking as well as choice of weapon, these are characteristics that I mentioned earlier found more in serial rather than mass murder.
Yeah.
There was clear premeditation that likely included a fantasy element involved given the nature of the crimes and an organized plan. The attack was a blitz-style attack, but he thought about it a lot before and probably thought he had covered all of his bases, given that he turned his phone off during the crime and employed other forensic countermeasures after the murders.
Mm-hmm.
He was meticulous in cleaning up the car and apartment, tried and failed to delete or alter his Amazon purchase history,
mm-hmm.
but he did use software to wipe his phone and laptop, which is why they did not get much from these devices.
Yeah, I mean, it'd be interesting to see what he wiped from that other than just like location data.
Right. Mm-hmm. Search history, lots of things probably.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, he seems like he's done some, maybe a lot of things like
yes.
pretty well, pretty good.
Oh yeah.
But then he also forgets that everybody has a Ring camera these days.
Right. So he was interested in studying cloud-based forensics and had previously authored a detailed paper on crime scene processing as an undergraduate. But reportedly, the camera on the residence that captures the vehicle, he may not have seen it as it looks more like a light bulb fixture.
Mm-hmm.
And he should have been looking for cameras on previous visits.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Another.
Well, I mean, I have Ring cameras.
Yes.
All around the house.
Yeah.
And some of them look
as
like cameras.
Yes.
And then like if you just have the regular Ring camera on your doorbell.
Yes.
It almost, it's just like inside the doorbell. So it's really almost unnoticeable.
Oh, okay.
Unless you just like really get up close to the house.
Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And this one, like I said, it looked like a light bulb fixture.
Mm-hmm.
So another area of focus for profilers is victim selection. And he did well by choosing victims that he had no known association or connection to.
Mm-hmm.
So that was a lower level risk of being identified as a suspect. They did get data from various platforms, including Tinder and Instagram, but he wasn't following any of them, nor had he interacted with them in any way on social media. So here's where we get back to target selection. There was an intentionality to target selection because he went upstairs first. Versus if you just want the experience of killing someone for the thrill of it, you just kill whoever is most convenient to avoid apprehension. In and out. That would have been whoever you encountered on the first floor that you came into. So his phone also started pinging in the area before Kaylee and Zanna had moved into the house. So given how visible Maddie's room was from the street, also lends some validity that she was the primary target. But that doesn't mean that he knew her or had any previous interaction with her. So you don't need to be an FBI profiler to know that is where you begin, right? With people who knew her, the last people who were seen with her, et cetera. But he was a stranger. So it seems as though he operated under the assumption that he would not be identified as a suspect in the first place and then covered up anything more obvious after the fact. But had he been thinking through every aspect of the crime, he might have considered getting the weapon in person from a store, so there's no order history that ties him to it. But the sheath with the DNA was the biggest screw up because he cleaned it, but he did not clean the inside of the snap. There was a very small bit of DNA that links him to the crime that was inside the snap.
You mean like he cleaned it before?
Well, there was no DNA on anything of any part of the sheath other the inside of the snap. So since it wasn't on the outside, right, like he knew to touch it with gloves or what, or clean it or whatever, but he didn't think about the inside of the snap. So when you're opening something, like your thumb or finger touches the inside of that snap, that's where they found it. I mean, it, like that's how minuscule. So as the profilers note, even if you plan everything ahead of time, you can make mistakes in the moment once the plan goes awry, like Zanna hearing him because she was awake and then him leaving the knife sheath. He was sloppy in some ways, like with changing the license plate 5 days after the murders and not checking for cameras everywhere. But it also could have been arrogance blinding him a bit. Given what he has been reported about his interactions with classmates, he could come across as arrogant. He may have been overly confident in his ability to, like, not, you know, clean up everything and not have himself linked to this. He did seem to have a problem with women. He challenged women, and this actually led to an issue with one of his professors for whom he was a teaching assistant, and that ultimately put his job in jeopardy, which happened before the crime. So do you think this could be a sexually motivated crime, even though he stabbed all four victims and fled the scene all within around 15 minutes?
Yeah, I mean, we talked about in the, like, the serial murder case that, or maybe it was the paraphilia.
I don't remember.
Serial killer episode or the paraphilia episode. We talked about erotophonophilia, where you can kind of, like, get off on violence. It doesn't necessarily have to be, like, sexual contact or interaction. So maybe he was a erotophonophile.
Yes, could be.
And, I mean, there's also, you know, other elements kind of in common with sexually motivated crimes, like the stalking and him, like, visiting the house and being in the area for, like, so many times so far ahead of the crime. Victim selection, the choice of a knife to kill, which is intimate but also high risk.
Right, and he also had lots of indicators, as I said, of needing to control and dominate conversations, especially with women. He had lots of lifestyle control issues. You know, he was a very strict vegan. Fantasy is likely a motivating factor, and you don't need an overtly sexual act to fulfill the fantasy. It still fills the need. On the other hand, we won't know this until we have some evidence of it, but he could have been an incel.
We have a quite a recent episode on incels, so check that one out.
So he did not seem to have any significant relationships. He did have friends, but was also bullied and developed a drug habit during high school. One Tinder date said she never went out with him again because he started weirdly tickling her. Like, he just started tickling her, and she was kind of like, you know, that's, I don't like that. And he just kept doing it. So she thought it was weird. She asked him to stop, and then she just ghosted him. He also suffered from a condition called visual snow, which he discussed in an online forum. Mm-hmm. He was intelligent academically, but socially awkward. He did have high praise from some of the professors that he studied under, indicating some academic ability, including Catherine Ramslin, who interviewed famously BTK, Dennis Rader, mm-hmm. And published several books about those interviews.
Wow.
She described him as, quote, very polite, respectful, seemed genuinely engaged with the material as a potential researcher, teacher, somebody who was interested in a career.
Mm.
Ultimately, the answer to why did he do it could just be because he wanted to.
Mm.
And he did have an academic interest in the subject, but just decided that he would rather become a practitioner instead.
Well, that's an interesting way to put it.
Yes. Yep.
Well, you got anything else?
I do not.
Okay, then let's wrap it up with our Minute to Spin It, where we give our takeaway from the show today. So, Tommy, in just a minute, what's your spin?
Criminal or psychological profiling as portrayed in media is not realistic, but profilers do engage in some behavioral analysis that is helpful in the study of multi-site and other crimes. Mm-hmm. In addition to research using crime scene or geographic profiling, you may be able to link crimes together, which is helpful in the study of serial murder, but that's about all. Most crimes are solved the old-fashioned way, which is true in this case as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Ben, what's your spin?
Idaho? No, Utah. Anyway, I thought that I would give some Idaho fun facts today. And I'm not going to include potatoes in any of these since everyone knows that Idaho and potatoes are associated.
Yes, and they rhyme. Mm-hmm. It rhymes.
Idaho potato. Yeah, you're right. And But I do love a good potato.
Oh, love potato.
Yeah, potatoes. Anyway, Idaho is a made-up word. When the state needed a name, this man claimed that the word Idaho was Shoshone for Gem of the Mountains, but he just made that up. He just lied and made that up. That's not true.
He just liked the name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but the name stuck.
Yeah.
Idaho, anyway, made up word. Idaho is also the top producer in the U.S. of trout and has a booming aquaculture industry, which is pretty interesting. Cool. And you can see our Fish Justice episode to check that out.
That's hard to say.
Mm-hmm.
Fast.
And yeah. And finally, and you might find this particularly interesting, Idaho has a ton of like abandoned ghost towns.
Cool. Very cool.
So like the gold rush and mining boom and bust in the 1800s resulted in like a lot of towns and settlements being built quickly and then abandoned. Quickly. So lots of ghost towns and ghost tours across the state.
Very cool.
Yeah. Well, that's Idaho for you. So anyway, although it does have its uses, profiling isn't some mystical power where, you know, profilers look at crime scenes and can intuit the, you know, race, age, and shoe size of the perpetrator of a crime. And hopefully we have cleared that up today.
We are a community-driven podcast sponsored by the Gandhi Center and produced by JMU Libraries. Check out our website linked in show notes to see how you can support our educational programming.